I really want to thank Mr. Brandenburg and the choir for putting that together. Rob Poffenroth, who did the visuals, he and his wife are in Jamaica this year for the feast. And just the photography is stunning, and the words are just so appropriate and so inspiring. If we can't go home from the feast inspired, I think there's something wrong. There's so much to be encouraged and uplifted about. So good to be here, so good to see familiar faces. Some haven't seen in a long time. Special welcome to Mr. and Mrs. Cole, who are here. I ran into him yesterday, and he used to be my former boss for a while as he was the Canadian director. And there are some others that I haven't had a chance to chat with yet, but that's why God gives us 8 days to be able to do so. This summer, you know how it is in the summertime. You like to do some kind of light reading on vacation. It doesn't take a lot of mental strain. So what I decided to do this summer for my own personal Bible study was to do some reading about a character in the Bible that I hadn't read about for a while. And the more I read, the more I began to realize that there's a lot here. And it began to gel toward what is now a Feast of Tabernacles message. We all have an interest in personalities and people, don't we? People magazine is popular. Programs like Entertainment Tonight focuses on Hollywood celebrities is popular. We like to read about people and their lives, and we like to follow them, especially people who are celebrities. So we're up with Mel Gibson, his problems, Tom Cruise, things he's going through, Robin Williams, some of the setbacks he's had. And I wanted to focus a bit on a personality in the Bible. I think, to me, he is a gold standard personality in the Scriptures. And of course, if you read the festival brochure, you know I'm talking about King David. Ironic, I called Dave Campbell. I said, I hope you're not talking about, he said, King of Kings. I hope you're not talking about King David also. Yeah. But he said, no, yeah, he assured me. And actually, we're amazed how the two dovetail together. David means beloved. He is a famous sculpture by Michelangelo. If you've been to Rome, perhaps you've seen it. Actually, we were on a cruise about a year ago on a Carnival Pride cruise, and then there's a special supper club that they have. You have to reserve to get in there, and it's kind of an all-evening affair, but it's called David's Supper Club, and they have a life-size statue of King David in there, a replica of it. Very awesome. And then surfing on the internet again, I realized that in Jerusalem there is a luxury hotel, a King David Hotel in Jerusalem. In the last decade, just Googling a bit about King David, at least 6 books have been written about him. And, you know, ironically, higher intellectualism and scholarship, some scholars actually deny that he even lived. Now, the question is the validity of his life. There's not a lot outside of the Bible about David. There's a fragmentary Aramaic inscription found in Tel Dan in 1993 and 1994, dating back to about 850 BC, and it mentions, quote, the house of David in reference to the kingdom of Judah. And as you read some of the things that have been written about David, some authors depict him as a serial killer, as ruthless. But we need to go to the Word of God, the primary source, the Bible. One thing that really struck me as I was going, just doing my summer reading, was how much is written about him. I started reading, I'll take a short read, and I went on about 62 chapters in the Bible about his life. Only 14 chapters are written about Abraham. There is more devoted to King David in the Bible than there is to Moses or Jesus Christ. And I kind of listed 1 Samuel 16 to 31, 2 Samuel, the entire book, chapters 1 to 23, 1 Kings, chapters 1 and 2, 1 Chronicles 11, to 29, which is basically a retelling from a different theological vantage point, emphasizing his positive side more. And not only is there all that written about him, but also he wrote at least, we know, 73 songs. Many of them we sing. A quote here from Halley's Bible Handbook: David's creation of the Psalms was in reality a far grander accomplishment than the creation of the kingdom, the legacy he's left behind. Beautiful words, beautiful lyrics. He was referred to, among others, as the sweet psalmist of Israel. He was the second king. He reigned for a total of 40 years, and he made Jerusalem the capital city. We know that he came from Bethlehem, which is interesting also, because the more I read about David, the more analogies you see between him and Christ. The word Bethlehem means house of bread. And Jesus Christ came from Bethlehem, the true bread from heaven. I thought that was interesting. David was a warrior. One reason he could not build the temple, because he shed a lot of blood. But you know, one thing he did was he subdued his enemies, as Christ will subdue his enemies and finally hand everything over to his Father. The way David handed everything over in a state of peace to his son, who basically set up almost like a type of a millennial reign. I gave a sermon a few years ago on King Solomon, a type of a millennial reign. David was a warrior, a military genius. He was a brilliant statesman. He was a poet, a musician, a king, a shepherd. And most of all, he loved God totally, deeply. And you know, God probably has things he says about virtually everybody. And if our names come up, I wish this could be said of me. You know, we know God called Abraham his friend. Acts 13 and verse 22. Acts 13 and verse 22. I think when God says something about an individual, he means it and it's accurate. And we should pay attention. So Acts 13 verse 22, and it says, when he had removed him, Saul, he raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do my will. David, in many ways, had the heart of God. If you want to know more about the heart of God, study the heart of David. You know, we desperately in this world need role models, not comic books, not movie celebrities, but real people, flesh and blood people like ourselves. Not perfect, with our own faults and flaws. And David is a wonderful role model. Why would God otherwise not devote at least 62 chapters to him? He was referred to, some of the Bible commentaries, impetuous, sensitive, bold, poetic, compassionate, utterly human. What can we learn from this young warrior of a long time ago? How could God call David a man after his own heart when we know he was a bloody man? He sinned. He made some major mistakes in his life. Obviously, that was worked through. And in spite of all of that, God still said what he did about David. By observing and learning more of his character and actions, we too can learn to be more men and women after God's own heart. You know the account when Saul was told to go anoint David to be king. He was just a youth, a young man. I'm not quite sure how old. But in 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7, this is what God saw. He saw what was inside, his inner core, his character. In 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7, and God told Samuel, it says, Don't look at his appearance or at his physical stature. And this is one of his brothers. He said, I refused him, for God does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. And God saw all the sons of Jesse, and here are the youngest one, something special in his heart that God made Samuel come to see, to anoint him to be a future king. And you know, the amazing thing is, so many amazing things, is that God made a very special covenant with this man. An agreement between he himself and David, and in David's progeny. And that covenant cannot be broken. It's still in effect today. We have literature on it. Jeremiah chapter 30 refers to that covenant in verse 20 to verse 22. Jeremiah chapter 33, beginning in verse 20. Thus says the Lord, if you can break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so that there be no night or no day in their season, then, he says, my covenant may also be broken with David. And we still have night and day. God's covenant is still in force today. He said, my servant, so that he shall not have a son to reign on his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. So there still has to be somebody reigning today on the throne of David. And of course we understand, and have, you know, published material on it, that she's in Westminster Abbey. I'm sorry, she was coronated at Westminster Abbey and lives in Buckingham Palace. And he says, as the host, verse 22, of heaven cannot be numbered or the sand of the sea measured, so will I multiply the descendants of David, my servant, and the Levites who minister unto me. When Jesus Christ was born in the flesh, his genealogy came through King David. Matthew 1, verse 1, where some people get into genealogy. Jesus Christ's genealogy in verse 1 referred to two individuals. Primarily, first of all, it says, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Why talk about David at the Feast of Tabernacles? Good question. Because of millennial prophecies. Let's review a few of them. Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 7. We're familiar with this, referring to the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. It says, of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end upon the throne of David, and over his kingdom to order it, establish it with judgment and justice from this time forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. There will be a lot of enthusiasm to carry that out. Christ will sit on the throne of David in the world tomorrow. And in Hosea chapter 3 and verse 5, Hosea chapter 3 and verse 5, it says, afterwards, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. David is a future king over Israel throughout the world tomorrow. And let's face it, if he's going to be around as a king of Israel for 1,000 years, kind of nice to know more about him. I mean, we like to know all about our political leaders and read everything we can. I think it's great to know as much as we can about the future king of Israel that will report directly to Jesus Christ, and who actually has land allocated to him beside the temple on both sides, who has a specific gate allocated to him that he goes in and out of in a temple service. Amos chapter 9 and verse 11, Amos 9 and verse 11 See, on that day, I will raise up the tabernacles of David, which have fallen, and repair its damage. I will raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old. Who got the temple going, the process? Who sought to build a temple? David did. Who prepared for it? He did. Who's going to be involved in the temple, the tabernacle, in the world tomorrow? Heavily, David. Jeremiah chapter 30 and verse 9, millennial prophecy. Jeremiah 30 and verse 9, it says, they shall serve the Lord their God and David their king, who I will raise up for them. Peter said David is dead and buried, but not when Christ returns. He will awaken in the resurrection. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 37, a millennial prophecy. Without reading it all, if you start in verse 21, talks about God taking the children of Israel from among the various nations, bring them back to their own land. They're going to be one nation in the land. Verse 22, there's going to be one king over them. They no longer will be two nations. There will be no more defilement. Then verse 24 says, David, my servant, shall be king over them. And they shall all have one shepherd. They should also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. And it says at the end of verse 25, and my servant David shall be their prince forever. If you, which I took some time to go through some of the millennial prophecies in Ezekiel, because we know that the latter chapters of Ezekiel are all millennial also. I'll just refer you to a few of them without taking time to elaborate. But Ezekiel 44, the first three verses, I'll read that. It says, then he brought me back to the outer gate of the sanctuary, which faces toward the east, but it was shut. And the Lord said unto me, this gate shall be shut. This is the eastern gate of the temple in the world tomorrow. It shall not be opened, and no man shall enter by it, because the Lord, the God of Israel, has entered by it. Jesus Christ will go through that specific gate. He has his own entrance. Will have his own entrance. Therefore, it shall be shut. As for the prince, and David is referred to as the prince in Ezekiel 37, as for the prince, because he is the prince, he may sit in it to eat bread before the Lord. He shall enter by way of the vestibule of the gateway and go out the same way. Specific entrance that David will come and go out of. Eating bread with Jesus Christ in a world tomorrow. Not that you need bread, physical human beings, but still be able to, capable of doing that. And then, if you there are sections in Ezekiel 45, it talks about the land, some portion of land that will be given to him, how he'll be responsible for certain offerings. And that's Ezekiel 45, verse 7, and also verse 25. And then it talks about Ezekiel 46, verses 9 to 18, about inheritances and gifts concerning David. And also a section, Ezekiel 48, verses 21 and 22, about David functioning in the temple area and the world tomorrow. So as a future king, I think it's good to learn as much as we can from him, from his life, trying to learn lessons for our own life. I think a lot of us might enjoy, you know, the series Biography. And it would be beautiful if somebody could put together a biography of King David. Now, air it as a 1 or 2 hour special. Wouldn't that be? There'd be a lot of material to cover. We know that the mother of his grandfather, Obed, was Ruth, the Moabitess, the Gentile blood, and David. Of the wife or wives of Jesse, we know nothing. The scriptures are silent. The personality of the mother of David, we don't know much about. But there is a possibility that she could have been of the tribe of Moab. Why? Well, one indication, when David was pressed and being pursued by Saul, one thing David did was he found his parents and he placed them under the protection of the king of Moab. Possibly because of the connection his mother might have. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says to form a correct opinion of anyone is much more difficult than to state the facts of their life. A lot of people have opinions. I've heard some people say in the church, I really have a hard time with David. I know all the things that he did. I really can't respect him. I would imagine that those are some of the things that he would face in the world tomorrow. Snickers, sly comments, judgmental statements. Because he was not whitewashed. He was pictured accurately by his life. And yet God has seen beyond that. How would you like it if God chronicled everything about you and then put it in a book and had generations read it for thousands of years? You know, how would you cope with that? It could be embarrassing. And we used to ask, what is your most embarrassing moment? And we've all had embarrassing moments, so imagine if they were all chronicled for people to read. They said here, the character of David must remain like that of everybody, an insolvable enigma. Well, we know that he had godly character. A person is to be judged by his motives rather than by his actions. You know, not actions alone. God judges the heart. And one's true motives are unknown, sometimes even to ourselves, because we can deceive ourselves. You know, his name is mentioned over 1,000 times in the Bible. So I'm going to quote everyone. Joke. Let's just read a few things. You know, this is a frustrating topic to cover, because how do you take a personality, a biblical figure, 62 chapters, and boil it down to 50, 60-minute sermon? So you just hit highlights. And maybe as a result, it might cause you to do some reading and studying yourself. What did he look like? Teenage girls would kind of oogle. He was a hunk. He was a hunk. He was not ugly. He wasn't a slob. He carried himself well. He was handsome. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 12. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 12. So he sent and found him. This is when he's going to be anointed. And it describes him. Now he was ruddy. What is ruddy? Well, ruddy, it means rosy, with a healthy reddish glow. He was not pale. Other words might be reddish, rosy, flushed, glowing, versus being pale. He had bright eyes. You know, bright eyes. And it says, and good looking. And good looking. And God says, arise, anoint him. This is the one. Just because he was off by himself and the runt of the litter, he would have been cast in a Hollywood film very easily, I'm sure. Also, in verse 18 of 1 Samuel chapter 16, this is a report given to Saul. Then one of the servants answered and said, look, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing. He took music lessons. I'm sure He enjoyed performing, maybe at the feast, maybe he played a musical instrument. He's also a mighty man of valor, a man of war. And notice also prudent in speech. He was a good speaker. Just like Jesus Christ, they marveled at the words that came out of his mouth, saying, you know, isn't he from Galilee? David was the same way. Prudent in speech and a handsome person. And God was with him. In verse 15, he was very mature. He behaved himself. He wasn't a goofy teenager then. It says, verse 15, therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. Paul was actually intimidated. Saul was the king, huge guy, and he's intimidated by this young man, threatened by him. People loved him. They loved him. Well, it's a love-hate relationship. There were times they were ready to stone him. But for the most of the time, he was very popular. 1 Samuel 18, verses 5 to 7. 1 Samuel 18, 5 to 7. So David went out wherever Saul sent him, and he behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Then they came home, and they had the tambourines playing. And they met him coming from war with musical instruments. So verse 7, the women sang and they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. He was a gutsy guy. And 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 36. To show how popular he was. So, you know, read these, you realize that he had charisma. He had a nice personality. You enjoyed being around him. He was a people person. 2 Samuel 3, verse 36, now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people. He actually, as I'm reading about him, he was not autocratic. He sought consensus. He sought advice, and then he did the best thing that needed to be done. Most of all, he sought God's advice. Actually, as I was reading about David, you know, thinking a man after God's own heart, as you go through the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, you can go through every one of the Beatitudes and find examples in his life where he reflects the Beatitudes. Humble, very humble. 2 Samuel 7, 18. But God told him what he's going to do, bless him, the covenant. 2 Samuel 7, 18. That David went in and sat before God and said, who am I, Lord God, and what is my house that you have brought me this far? He was actually blown away at what God was doing in his life. Very humble about it. You know, we heard whole sermons, and probably the best childhood story ever is David and Goliath, right? And perhaps a feature of his character which stands out, especially in his earlier years, is his boundless physical courage. He was fearless. He shirked danger. He delighted in hairbreadth escapes. You know, he snuck in a cave a couple of times and cut off Saul's robe, snuck back out. He met the giant Goliath. According to the Bible reading program, Goliath, the figures we have, is 9 feet 9 tall. Pretty big guy. He'd have a hard time walking through any of our doorways here in full military gear. And he went against him with a sling and some stones. And what, you know, if you read about the valiant men that he had around him, he was equally valiant. He was their leader. And in Chronicles, it talks about some of the valiant men and how with one of them slew with his bare hands 300 people, and another one defeated the whole army by himself. And he was your leader. He was like that. You don't win the kind of battles that he won, even with God's help, without being courageous. And he's talking to Saul, and this goes along with what David projected on the screen about the lion. 1 Samuel 17, 33 to 37, trying to convince Saul that he can go against Goliath. He was not intimidated by him. And because he was just a youth. And David said, verse 34, he said, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came out and took the lamb out of the flock, I went after it, struck it, delivered the lamb from his mouth. When it arose against me, I caught it by the beard, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." And it wasn't totally on his own. He realized God helped him. Verse 37, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the Philistine." Look at today. We marvel and we get all oogly-eyed about somebody that wrestles with alligators or swims with sea rays. Imagine you have somebody that wrestles lions, barehanded. Just looking at those creatures, how do you do it? Yeah, imagine the battle, barehanded, and rolling in the dirt and grabbing a hold of him, and a lion trying to snap at him. And wherever he held him good and was able to kill him with a club or whatever he used, his bare hands. Normally, he'd say, "Wow, okay, there's another lamb that's lost. Got to tell my dad." He said, "No, can't let one go." My wife and I, we've had bear encounters over the years. Last summer, we had one bear encounter from about here to the wall over there, walking down a narrow path on the Queen Charlotte's, and a great big black bear walking right toward us. I don't think I'd want to tackle him barehanded. My first reaction was to lift my gun up and put a bullet in the chamber and hope the first bullet gets him if he comes at me. I know one individual lives here in Kelowna. He had an encounter with a grizzly bear, and he had a rifle, and he still gets nightmares over it. He didn't have a gun. He had bare hands. Took on a bear. Courageous. He's prudent, we know that. Actually, prudence or wisdom, if you're a biographer, would be remarkable things to explore, how prudent he was, the way he handled himself in his life. He was very noble. You know, he was not crass, but he was converted. The only converted person of his time, actually. You know, look at the beautiful eulogies that he did for the death of Saul, his enemy. For Jonathan. For Abner. For Absalom. And his nature was untainted with malice. Some of these guys were out to kill him. Yet he broke down and cried, he wept, he fasted. And he spoke beautiful words about them. He loved his enemies. And he prayed for them. A man after God's own heart. No guile, no malice. No desire for vengeance. Left that in God's hands. He had good relationships. Not with everybody. He tried to have good relationships. But we know the relationship he had with Jonathan. Strong friend, strong ties. It talks about how their love was so great, and this was a normal, natural love of two individuals. He showed he was capable. He had many friends. Actually, thing I discovered, I didn't know that, but he also had foreign friends. Sometimes you get friends, you get a little tiny clique, and you know, you're always together, and nobody can break that clique, and just, you know, two or three of you. But David was not cliquish. He did not ostracize people. It seems still strange that two of his best friends were from two enemy nations. Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, and Achish, lord of Gath. They're from enemy nations, and they were part of his circle of friends. He had, you could say, church friends and friends out in the world. One thing about David, he was wholehearted. Whatever he did with all of his might. There was no halfway. He had total enthusiasm. And this was God talking to Jeroboam in 1 Kings 14 and verse 8. And tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, yet, talking to Saul, or to Jeroboam, yet you have not been as my servant David, who kept my commandments, who followed me with all of his heart, to do only what was right in my eyes. You know, we can read about him bringing back the ark, the music, the dancing, the celebration. He made that a wonderful event. You read about what he did when he got enthusiastic about building a temple and the collection for it and the monies, the donations. In 1 Kings 11 and verse 4, here's what God also says about David and his wholeheartedness. 1 Kings 11 and verse 4. For so it was when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. And also, God says in, this is an interesting verse actually, 1 Kings 15 and verse 5. 1 Kings 15 and verse 5. It says, God said, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and had not turned aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. God does not use the term. We make movies, David and Bathsheba. God said, refers to the whole episode as the matter of Uriah the Hittite. God speaking. I thought that was interesting. He loved his enemies. It troubled him in 1 Samuel 24 and verse 5 that he had even cut off a part of Saul's robe. And they came at him. They couldn't understand him. He was a paradox, an enigma. He was converted. That's why they couldn't understand him. In 1 Samuel 24, verses 18 and 19, it says, and you have shown this day how you have dealt with me, for when God delivered me into your hands, you did not kill me. This is Saul speaking. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? Scratching his head. How can you do that? That doesn't make sense. And then when Saul died, he treated Saul's family respectfully, kindly. In 2 Samuel, after Absalom's death, and Absalom, yeah, he's pretty disrespectful. He tried to take over the kingship. He defiled his wives. He sent David into exile. And after Absalom died, in 2 Samuel 19, verse 6, he was crying. He lost his son. He's crying. He was in mourning. And they said, in that you love your enemies. Seemed like you hate your friends. You love your enemies more than your friends. For you had declared today that you regard neither prince nor servants For today I perceive if Absalom had lived and all of us had died, then you'd been pleased. You're being a little sarcastic. Remember Shimei when he was fleeing from Absalom? And David's small entourage. And there was a guy, Shimei, throwing dirt, swearing at him, cussing him. 2 Samuel 16, verses 11 to 13. And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "See how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life? How much more now may this Benjaminite?" He said, "Let him alone. Let him curse. For so the Lord has ordered him. It may be that God will look on my afflictions, that the Lord may repay me for the good of his cursing this day." He took bad press. He disregarded it. He said, maybe I deserve it. Maybe I have it coming. If the hat wears, I'll fit it. So as David, verse 13, his men went along the road, Shimei went along the hillside opposite and cursed as he went, threw stones at him, kicked up dust at him. You know, I think one major hallmark is that David was not afraid to admit he'd made mistakes. Sometimes it took him a while. Like, it takes us a while. You know, sometimes it takes certain things to get us to smarten up. And David was repentant. He had personal faults. He was human. God does not whitewash him. I mean, he lived 70 years. His faults, if you take 70 years of life and his faults, what portion of that is that? Yet it seems like most people just will look at the faults and ignore the vast majority of his life and all his accomplishments and the good things he did. His faults show that God's servants can go from highs to lows, from strong faith to fears to doubts. We're human. You know, sometimes we're like that. He's artsy also. The incident with Uriah, midlife crisis, he was around 50, possibly. He didn't even go out to war anymore. He's out staying home. He was a ruler of the most powerful nation on the earth at that time. One sin led to the other. There was cover-up. And, you know, the thing is about Uriah, he's probably a foreign mercenary. God refers it as a matter of Uriah the Hittite. Uriah had devoted his life to the service of David. And, you know, another thing with the matter of Uriah the Hittite, the way David instructed was not the way it was done. Joab thought he would do David a favor and make it look more accidental. So it actually resulted in more death than just Uriah. And he ordered him to go close to the wall and then withdraw. You know, God is watching from a distance. And God dealt with that. And David wrote one of the most beautiful psalms in the Bible, Psalm 51. He didn't justify himself. He admitted he made a mistake. He dealt with it, and he went on. And God forgave him. And, of course, there was penalties involved, and he paid the penalties. He tried to get God to change his mind. He fasted for a week. It didn't work. But ultimately, Solomon was born. You know, even with Abigail, he listened to a woman's advice. And he actually listened and he responded. So he's willing to take admonition from anybody. Ended up marrying her later. He numbered Israel. And again, he had a lapse of faith. When do we have lapses of faith? Is our faith always strong? Well, apparently this time his faith wasn't that strong because he began to look at numbers. Have we looked at numbers? We talk a lot about numbers. And I think God has taught us a lesson that numbers aren't that important. I mean, God can win victories through a Gideon, a Samson, a small flock. He paid a heavy price for that. 70,000 people died. Sometimes, through our lack of faith, others can suffer. What about Uzziah touching the ark? That was, David should have known better. He had not studied the Bible thoroughly enough. And he, in this, again, it shows the sincerity in serving God is not enough. He was sincere, but it has to be done God's way. And Uzziah died when he touched the ark. David didn't want to move it anymore. Well, 3 months later, then he had figured out what was wrong, and he came and did it the right way. So he learned by his mistakes. He corrected them. He had passion for numerous women. It got him in a lot of trouble. He did not read, or maybe he read, but did not follow what it says, directed the kings in Deuteronomy 17, verse 17. It says, neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. This got Solomon in trouble. The apple did not fall far from the tree. David had a problem there, but they did not turn his heart from God. At one time in his life, he had 6 children by 6 different women in 7 years. And so sometimes women read these things and they say, I don't like David. Yeah. There's more. He had more later. He had 4 more sons through Bathsheba. He had 9 sons by other wives and more through concubines. Some of those things, you scratch your head. But you understand that polygamy was a factor in that culture, especially outside of Israel. But as a result of this, there's lessons we can learn. God gave us one. One is enough. Some people say one sometimes is too much. But, as a result, he suffered a lot of family infighting. There was rivalry among the wives, among the kids. There was jealousy. There was a rape. There was a murder. There was an attempted coup. Absalom was aware of David's sin of adultery. He's probably a teenager. How do you think he felt about that? Probably David was rarely home when the children were growing up. Was he a great family man? No, he wasn't. He wasn't a great family man. 5 years went by without him even seeing his grandchildren through Absalom. For 5 years, he didn't see them. They were living right in the same city. He refused to go see them. He did not balance work and family. Maybe he was a workaholic. He did a lot, but the family suffered. He did not address family problems head on, and he did not spend enough time to direct and correct his children in a timely manner. Something he just ignored. But for all of us, it's easy to see and condemn the sins of others, even when they stare up at our own faces. I think some of David's problems with family, I think in the early years of the ministry, a lot of ministers would tell you, yeah, they've made the same mistakes. Too much work to do. Got to do the work. I still, to this day, regret the last time I saw my father, who lived here in Kelowna. He's buried right here in Kelowna. We were at a feast in Penticton, and he had ordered a Seiko hunting rifle from Finland. And he came up to me and says, I want you to have this when I die. He's only 55. I said, oh, Dad, you're being silly. Don't talk about that. He said, well, let's go hunting for a few days. We were right here. We were 2,500 miles away. I had to get back to Ontario. I said, no, Dad, I got to go. I got the blessing of children to do. Might be one or two children to bless after services. So I'll do it next time. That was the last time I saw him alive. Because, you know, trying to do the work. I still have the rifle, but one regret, I didn't spend that time with my father. We tend to be more tolerant for ourselves than we are for others. I read a story. You know, and David dealt with all this. His sins were public. People knew about it. But he went on and he lived his life. And he did it the right way after he made the mistakes. And that's what God looked at. I heard of a story of two brothers in a small village. And they got into hard times, so they stole some sheep. They were caught and they were branded on their foreheads. ST, sheep thief. They handled it differently. One of the brothers could not deal with it. He languished, he pined away. He could not take the humiliation. And finally, he just moved away somewhere else, never to be heard from again. The other brother stayed there, straightened out his act, and lived a good life. He died. And some young people were talking about him after his death, quite a few years after his death. He said, what, you know, yeah, so-and-so, what a nice guy, blah, blah, blah. I can't remember, what's that ST on his forehead? And the other boy says, "That I think that stood for saint." Yeah. And that's what David did. So he went on with his life. And he ran the course. And he finished the race strongly. He didn't run and cower and hide. He honored his mother and father. In 1 Samuel chapter 22, 1 Samuel 22, verses 3 and 4, says, "So David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, 'Please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me.' So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him in a time that David was in a stronghold." He made sure his mother and father were taken care of. Did not neglect them. Just like Christ, you know, some of his last words was to remember his mother. He consulted with God regularly. He was not self-willed. He had the priests around him. They carried the Urim and the Thummim. Any military issues, he went and consulted God in 2 Samuel 5 about this battle with the Philistines. Do we go? What do we do? The matter of building God's house went to Nathan the prophet. Where to establish his own residence after Saul's death, he consulted. Asked God, he was led to Hebron. He turned to God in times of trouble. What do? Times of trouble, a lot of us, we run from God. We stop going to church. We avoid the ministry. We kind of hide under a rock. In times of trouble, he ran to God. One incident in 1 Samuel 30, the whole chapter, This is you know, a lot of trouble. His followers, this village had been ransacked, raided. They showed up, and all their wives were taken away captive, all their children to an Amalekite invasion. Two of David's wives had been carried away. They were taken captive. They were all greatly distressed, and they spoke of actually stoning David. They were so upset. And God, he sought advice through the priest, Abiathar the priest, did what he was told to do. They found the kidnappers, retrieved all their belongings, retrieved through a military victory, all their children, all their wives. But the first thing he did was he consulted with the priest how to do things. He prayed. Some people, you know, in society think, well, for a man to pray, that's kind of, you know, wimpy. You know, women can pray, but, you know, men, well, I don't know. It's kind of a sign of weakness. He said in one of his psalms, Psalm 55, 17, he said, evening and morning and at noon, I will pray and cry aloud, and he'll hear my voice. He prayed regularly. He had faith, a man of faith. He said in Psalm 56, verse 11, in God I have put my trust. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? This is an interesting verse. I'll read it again. Psalm 56 and verse 11. In God I have put my trust. Does this sound familiar to the Americans? This is actually the origin of the American national motto, which I think they're trying to have tried to do away with in the court system. In God we trust. It comes from Psalm 56, verse 11. This is a shortened form of the longer Pilgrim motto, in God we trust, God with us. Abbreviated from the Pilgrim motto, taken from here, American motto. He fasted. David fasted. We talk about prayer, Bible study, fasting. He fasted. He said in Psalm 109:24, he says, my knees are weak through fasting. My flesh is feeble from lack of fatness. What was the first thing he did when his son got sick through Bathsheba? He went without food for a week. 1 week he fasted. He meditated. We talk about prayer, Bible study, meditation. He meditated. In Psalm 63, verse 6, when I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. He's also very organized. That's one thing that struck me, especially going through Chronicles. He organized his army very well. He did not let details fall through the crack. He organized the priesthood. He organized his government. He organized his own personal household. He organized the temple through plans. Actually, interesting the story of the location of the temple that Solomon built on, the temple that Christ will be sitting in. He actually purchased the location from Ornan the Jebusite. This is the place where the death angel stopped. It was 70,000 that died through his lack of faith. And this was the threshing floor where chaff was separated from grain. That last spot, the plague stopped. He went and bought, and he paid the fair price. He didn't, you know, he was not chintzy. He paid the fair price. He didn't say, can you give me a good deal? He probably paid more than he needed to. But this was a threshing floor where chaff was separated from grain. This is where Jesus Christ will sit in the world tomorrow. And it's interesting what it says about Christ in Luke 3 and verse 17. Luke 3 and verse 17. It says, referring to Christ, his winnowing fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly cleanse out his threshing floor and gather the wheat into his barn. But the chaff he will burn with unquenchable fire. A threshing floor analogy. He organized furniture, he organized materials, he organized music, he organized instruments. Had instruments built. He was, we talk in the church about servant leadership. He actually talked about it. These are some of the last things he talked about before he died. Normally, you know, if a person's about to die, you listen very carefully because this is a buildup over a lifetime. And you read his last words in 2 Samuel 23, starting in verse 1. These are the last words of David. Thus says David, the son of Jesse, thus says a man raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel. The Spirit of God spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the rock of Israel spoke to me, he who rules over men must be just. Ruling in the fear of God. Talked about leadership, godly leadership, servant leadership. And he shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, like the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. And he talked about some other things also, and some of his war temperament came out also, about use of the shaft and spear and utterly burned with fire in their place. What can we learn from his life? Lots, probably a lot more than I could possibly cover today. What can we learn? I think we can learn to continue to live the Beatitudes like he did. We need to learn to go beyond his mistakes and see him the way God saw him. He will be king over the 12 tribes of Israel for 1,000 years. The apostles were offered rulership, but each of them given one tribe of Israel. David is over all 12. David had to struggle for years before receiving his crown. He was actually anointed 3 times. Once by Samuel, once over Judah, once over all of Israel. There was no timetable. When God anointed him, there was no timetable. He calls us to be kings and priests. There's no timetable. There's a lot of years of struggle. He spent at least 10 years of his life fleeing from Saul. This was after he was anointed. He experienced at least one marriage where love turned to hate. Remember Saul's daughter, Michal? She loved him. She protected him from her father. But at the end, she despised him when he showed maybe a bare bottom. Maybe he's wearing a Scottish Highland kilt with no underwear. I don't know. He was just celebrating, bringing the ark, and she despised him. And she became childless. Just the way Christ experienced a divorce, a marriage breakup of Old Testament Israel. David fought. He fought the Ammonites. He fought the Jebusites. He fought the Perizzites. He fought the Philistines. We fight. But we fight the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, the poles of this world. Are Jebusites and Perizzites and Philistines. His character and obedience to God was developed greatly by his years of trials and tribulations. He spent a lot of time in tears. At the end of his reign, God gave Israel rest from their enemies. He became the dominant ruler of the known world at that time. Israel, for a while, was a superpower. I don't have time, but it's really interesting as you go. There's one section in 1 Chronicles chapter 19 where forces were allied against him, mercenary forces, and they came from not only the neighboring nations, but also from Assyria and Babylon. Assyria was not yet a dominant empire, but this is a part of the mercenary force that came against him, a joint expeditionary force. And if I remember right, there were 32,000 chariots. Solomon, at his height, only had 1,400 chariots. And he fought them. And they won. And they went back to Assyria and Babylon, their tail between their legs. And there was no major world power except for David and Israel at that time. Defeated them all. And actually, as a result of those incidents, he wrote Psalm chapter 60. And he also wrote Psalm 108, verses 6 to 13. As a result of those battles. And actually, the prophetic Psalm, Psalm 83, could be dualistic, describing that event and also end time events. Again, Middle Eastern nations is allied with Assyria against Israel. That was a major battle. And if I remember right, there were 40,000 killed. And he was able to hand to Solomon, which means peaceful, a peaceful reign. Jesus Christ in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 24 to 28, reigns until all enemies are vanquished, including death. Then he hands everything over to his Father. In David's youth, he served in Saul's court. And before our calling, we serve in Satan's court. And as Saul came after David, so Satan pursues his people, a roaring lion. David gave in to temptations at a time of prosperity. He was mature, things were going good, and sometimes those are the times to be most aware and concerned. Ralph Klein, the premier of Alberta for a short while yet, he said it's a lot easier to govern when the province had less money. More difficult to govern when there's more money. He's a complex character, bottom line. God chose him, worked with him, corrected him, helped him, inspired him, and will use him for a long, long time. It was told in Luke 1, 31 to 33, "Behold, you shall conceive in your womb, shall bring forth a son, and shall call his name Jesus. He'll be great, will be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God will give unto him the throne of his father David. And he will reign over the house of Israel forever. Of his kingdom there will be no end." This is interesting. The rule of the Solomonic through Solomon line will cease. And the rule through another son of David, Nathan, will begin through Jesus Christ. On the day of Pentecost, Peter referred to a quote from David in Acts chapter 2. And David talking about himself in verse 27, he says, "You will not leave my soul in the grave, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You will make known to me the way of life, and you will make me full of joy in your presence." David looked for a resurrection. He looked forward to working with God. Remember we sang 23rd Psalm that Mr. Barrett led us through? David wrote it, and at the end he says, "I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." He knew about the resurrection. And he prayed, one part of his prayer, the final verse, the final quote, his Psalm 17 and verse 15, "As for me," he said, "I will see your face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake in your likeness." What do we learn? There's hope for all of us. God is merciful. God is just. If our hearts, our attitudes are right, God will not leave us or forsake us. We too, as future kings and priests, have a chance to serve under Jesus Christ with David, with other fellow servants, as long as we remain faithful, as long as we continue ourselves to have a heart and attitude that pleases God.